Welcome to BIO, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. BIO is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, we feature the first of a two-part special. It's a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer and historian T.J. Stiles. At BIO's 2026 conference in New York City this past May, Stiles received the organization's prestigious BIO Award. This annual honor recognizes a person who has advanced, in significant ways, the art and craft of biography. An apt description of Stiles. He was interviewed during BIO's conference by fellow biographer and BIO member, John, better known as Jack, Farrell.
Welcome to BIO, T.J. Stiles, winner of this year's BIO Award for great accomplishments and achievements and contributions to the craft. It is said that you are incapable of writing a book that does not become highly decorated. What is the key to a great biography? And in your answer, if you can, go ahead and cite two or three of your favorites and tell us what makes them great.
Wow, that's tough. It's tough because I think one of the dirty secrets of biographers is that we're so often researching our own work that we're not as well read in the genre as we should be. There's so many writers that I respect, and yet I've only read one or two of their works. You know, I was just telling Kai Bird, for example, that his biography of Jimmy Carter is really inspirational for my work on Theodore Roosevelt, which is still ongoing. And in part, it's because he made the bold choice to minimize his coverage of Jimmy Carter's post-presidential years, which, of course, were enormously consequential and eventful. And yet he made a choice about what his book was about. And that was very helpful for me thinking about where do I draw the lines around my take on Theodore Roosevelt, how my book will be framed. I think about someone like Jean Strauss, who I haven't read her most recent work about the Wertheimers and John Singer Sargent, but her J.P. Morgan biography, Morgan American Financier, so influential, so elegantly written, and full of insight into the people. So the phrasing and the insights go together. She writes at one point that Morgan was drawn to women with a touch of champagne in their veins. And that says so much and so elegantly. There are a lot of biographies that I find really influential for their form as well as for their insights, but not always the same. So, for example, McFeely's biography of Grant, which won the Pulitzer, I think his historical judgments are wrong in a lot of cases. I think his judgments of Grant are wrong, but it is a great book. And so sometimes a book may not be the best book on a subject, but it succeeds as a book.
So you talked a little bit about that in your speech to BIO, about finding out what it is that your story is as the writer or the biographer. How does McFeely do that? What, in the end, is his story of Grant?
Well, his book is really about someone who he felt that ultimately failed to rise to the occasion. And he's got a lot of judgments about Reconstruction, which I think went awry. A lot of his judgmentalism came in. And yet his depiction of the events are just so well done that I find it really compelling, even though there's better people who are working on the same subject now. So one of the things about a good biography is that it knows what it's about. And there's so many ways to do biography well. There's so many approaches you can take. And one of the questions people often ask when I say I'm writing about Theodore Roosevelt, oh, are you going to do a slice of his life or is it cradle to grave? And I'm an example. It's going to be not a slice, but it's going to be a lot more. It's going to be very in-depth for his years leading up to the White House, in the White House, and so that the book does not become unwieldy, it's going to have to deal much more lightly with his eventful and consequential post-presidential years.
I thought one of the things that you said about the biography of George Armstrong Custer was that you framed it as a book in which the frontier is time.
That's correct. He's landscape. A figure on a frontier in time.
A frontier in time. That's one of those phrases that just has sort of stuck with me as a way of thinking about how to, even within the limits of a chronology, change the context and tell an entirely different story, raising the emphasis you put on some details as opposed to what a military historian of the 1900s would have done writing the same type of biography. And then, of course, the stroke of minimizing Little Big Horn. Now, I had planned to just start with Jesse James and then move on through the books, but since we got to Custer quickly, tell me about that process of the frontier of time and what that meant to what you had to do when it came to discussing Little Big Horn.
Well, the thing is about Custer is that one of the reasons I was drawn to him is that his life is a travelogue through the vast landscape of the mid-19th century United States. He's from Ohio. He adopts Michigan as his home state. He fought in the Civil War. He traveled through the South. He served in Texas, served in Kentucky. And of course, he served in the Great Plains and Kansas and the Dakotas. And he also adopted New York as really one of the central hubs of his life. And so as I thought through his life, I came to realize that all of his life was defined by his contact with the transformation of the United States into what we would consider modernity, and how he was both through his, especially through his duties as an Army officer, he was helping to create that modernity, and yet he was at odds with it all the way through. So by framing it that way, what I'm doing is I'm not privileging the years in the West. I'm not even privileging, you know, his Civil War battles. Sort of like these are the events that made him significant. That's the way he's usually thought of. But rather, I'm thinking about the larger changes in the United States. So that, for example, when he is dealing with his battles and struggles in the Civil War, his relationship with the chain of command, the way that he sought advancement, his relationship with a self-emancipated black woman and her role in his brigade and then later in his life in the West as well, and how she was pursuing her own agenda. She was living her own life and pursuing goals that Custer did not see. But it's right there, all these changes in America are right there in the middle of his life. And yet, ironically, he was opposed to so many of them. So for my biography, yes, the Civil War battles matter, but just as much the way in which he hurled himself into Reconstruction politics and supported Andrew Johnson and served as a political delegate to his political conventions, and the way when he was deployed against the Ku Klux Klan, something that is usually relegated, 3 years that are usually relegated to a paragraph in a biography. And that was incredibly important to me to understand the role of the Army in this brief moment in which we had the establishment of civil rights and its enforcement, and how he was utterly opposed to it. That context is essential for understanding that his life in the West is a part of a huge and complicated life and a huge and complicated story of America going through changes, many of which were rolled back or warped. And he helps explain why they were rolled back or warped. You know, a man in the middle of the enforcement mechanism who's resisting it. And that's a personal story because within his household, he has someone who is pursuing the new America, you know, for her own self-advancement. He has his wife who very much believes in the equality of women, yet is too conventional to be, you know, political actor in that respect. All the complications of America going through these revolutionary changes are there in his life. And it just makes the story so much richer, and it's much less about concentrating on Custer as an abysmal character, as he could often be, and more about understanding the world and the people around him as well as him.
Yeah. It seems to me that that was also somewhat what you did with Jesse James. Not pre-industrial or pre-modernity, but also a symbol of his time.
Someone who was engaged, like Custer was, who was engaged with it. You know, usually the people who would write about Custer were interested in ultimately the military role he had, either in the Civil War or in the West. And, of course, that matters to me. He'd play a significant military role. But he was engaged with the politics. He was engaged with the rise of Wall Street. You know, he tried to launch a silver mine on Wall Street and sell shares in it and make a fortune in the new financial markets that were emerging after the Civil War. And Jesse James was someone who has been treated simply as a figure of folklore or as a criminal who used politics as an excuse to cover his crimes, and we can dismiss it. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you look at his life in its full context, which I think is the only way to understand him because there's so little documentary evidence that brings out his inner life, you understand that he was someone who was from a slave-owning family who was deeply engaged, he and his family deeply engaged in the struggle over the expansion of slavery into Kansas, whose family sided with the Confederacy in a badly divided state from the beginning. And out of all those post-Civil War outlaws, after he served as a Confederate guerrilla, his first actions were as a death squad going house to house, killing farmers who sided with the Union. That as a part of that vicious insurrection and counterinsurgency warfare in Missouri, he became an outlaw and he was definitely in it for the money. But out of all those post-Civil War outlaws, he's the only one who's using politics as an excuse. And there's no reason to think he was insincere. There's just assumptions that biographers and historians have carried into it that, of course, we must dismiss this person. Well, I take him seriously and ironically show him to be much more significant than many of his fans have thought him to be historically by taking him seriously. But of course, he's also a much darker figure mm-hmm. when you do that. But you understand him and you understand America better. And, you know, my biographies, I was trained as a historian and I spent 10 years after graduate school working in publishing and trade publishing. So it's books for the general public. And that sort of double, I consider that a double education. In the world of the book, as a successful accomplishment, writing a book that succeeds in and of itself as a book, and also creating historical knowledge. And so I'm always thinking both inward and outwardly about context and trying to create new knowledge about the context, about history, as well as create new knowledge about this individual and their significance. Yeah. And, you know, there are many fields of scholarship in which biographers work. And sometimes someone is just so well known that a biography can be great by just drilling down on that person and who they were in their inner life. Yeah. And the context is so known to us that they don't have to do that. I'm not telling everybody to do my kind of mm-hmm. biography. But I think both as a writer who's writing about a human being moving through the world, as someone who believes that the individual does matter, and finding that intersection of the individual and context that makes them significant, and also thinking about context, thinking about historical knowledge. I wish historians read my biographies more for the history as well as for just information about that life. Mm-hmm. The field of history has a very fraught relationship with biography. You know, they're still haunted by, you know, the idea of great Carlyle's dictum that great men make history. And so there has been a backlash against that idea. And of course, there's reasons for that. But at the same time, biography, I feel, is a genre that also overlaps with the various fields in which the subject operated. We're creating knowledge in that yeah. context as well.
You're fully credentialed as a historian.
Not fully. I went ABD.
Okay.
I don't have a doctorate.
You
so.
Did, you, strangely enough, there's a writer who didn't write his dissertation, right?
Exactly, yes.
When they moved the Pulitzer, famously, from the biography to the history category, was there any grumbling from the Academy? Oh, my God, one of these biographers is now taking over our turf as well?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that it's very interesting that, you know, the National Book Award is a jury makes all the decisions. And so what's great about the National Book Award, of course, and nonfiction covers everything. So you get surprises, you know. I mean, they're always wonderful books, but you get real surprises because it's a small group that decides. The Pulitzer, you're more likely to not find it so quixotic and not so, sometimes National Book Award winners can be difficult. The Pulitzer, you have a jury that picks the finalists, and then you have the board that includes past Pulitzer winners in all the arts and letters categories, all the journalism categories, and they read all the submissions and they make their choices. And so the Pulitzer, by definition, is a book that appeals to a larger audience. And so I always remind people, you know, the Pulitzer is ultimately for arts and letters is a literary award. And that, yes, the knowledge those books create matters, but it's not an award for the best book in that field in terms of the biggest contribution, the biggest splash it'll make in the field of history. Mm-hmm. There's no Pulitzer in sociology. You know, there's no Pulitzer in psychology. These are not scholarly awards. Those are history and biography are fields that are traditionally literary fields mm-hmm. as well as scholarly fields. But I do say that I don't want to be on an elevator with the three Pulitzer finalists in history because they yanked my book out of biography and put it in history. But that was back when they've since changed it, which is good. Memoir and autobiography used to be in the same category with biography, which yeah. biographers hated.
Yeah, we as a board wrote a strongly worded letter to the
public. And so, you know, Barbarian Days, the memoir of surfing, yeah. was the winner in biography and memoir. Yeah. And, you know, wonderful book. It deserves an award. But they liked my book a lot. Uh-huh. And so it was a finalist in biography. And they said, well, we actually like this better as a work of history than the history book. So, which again, says something about the contextual approach yeah. and the way I try to create historical knowledge. And the board can do that. Yeah. They do it a lot with drama. And it's because the board is concentrated in New York. They all go to see the play. The plays they actually saw are the ones that win.
So when I think of great editor and writer combinations, I think of Caro and Gottlieb. But I also think of you and John Siegel. Has he been the editor for all four books?
Yeah, I'm very lucky. I've had the same agent.
You are very lucky. Jonathan yeah. Siegel is a fantastic editor.
I've had the same agent for my entire career, and I've had the same editor. And John Siegel and I totally see eye to eye on our working relationship, which is, as John puts it, it's better to hear it from me than in a review. And, you know, you asked me before we started talking on the microphone about the relationship between martial arts and writing biography. And, you know, I've practiced traditional Shotokan karate with the Japan Karate Association since I was 16. So that's 112 years now. And I moved to New York right out of college, both to go to graduate school at Columbia, but also I actually got a worse fellowship at Columbia than I could have gotten elsewhere. But I wanted to practice with a man known to be the most traditional master in the Japan Karate Association, Mori Masataka. And Mori Sensei was, his last name is Mori, and very traditional. His nickname in Japan was Oni, which is, it's a horned demon of Japanese folklore. I mean, it's fierce. And I never learned a single compliment in Japanese, but I learned lots of insults. And the scariest thing he ever said to us, he used to actually hit us with a bamboo shinai, you know, and raise welts, never with the beginners, but with the senior students. Fierce. And the scariest thing he ever said to us was, oh, if you want, I no push. You know, I won't push you if you don't want me to, which is like saying, if you want to give up, I'll give up on you too. And we came to be pushed. We came to be in a place where there was no compromise. And that's the way I see writing. Like, this must work. This is not a vanity project. This is about me creating a successful book that works as, on some level, artistically, as a immersive, complete experience for the reader, and also creates knowledge. Now, you know, I take a subject like Theodore Roosevelt. I make no pretense that this will be, you know, the definitive book. I'm not writing three volumes, which is what I would have to do if I was writing the definitive book. But I want to be creating knowledge. I want people to come away saying, oh, I see him differently. He highlighted different things, like he put some things together. and also to feel rewarded just from the reading experience. Yeah. And so John Siegel is a wonderful, he's a lovely man. He's a mensch, but he doesn't pull punches when it comes to editing. And it's all about him helping me to make the best book I can.
Now, there's a story you tell about the Vanderbilt book.
Which one?
Yeah, exactly, the first one.
Right. It was, well, you know, Vanderbilt's life spanned from 1794. So he was born during George Washington's presidency. And he died in 1877 after the invention of the telephone. He'd made deals personally with John D. Rockefeller. His life spans the rise of the modern industrial, from the post-colonial strip of settlements when there was still slavery in New York, when 10% of the population of New York was enslaved, to when the United States was in a post-Civil War, post-emancipation, post-Reconstruction industrial state, the rise of the corporate economy. And he was at the center of that entire span, especially in economic terms, but in geographical terms as well, by being a transportation tycoon who always had an instinct for where the center of the main channel of commerce was. His story is also about the geographical expansion of the United States. But it started so early that what I was more familiar with was like the Civil War era and Reconstruction. His early life, I just didn't get it. So I drowned myself in the primary sources, and I found tons of stuff. And I wrote, you know, these long chapters that emphasized what I had found that I felt people hadn't written about before. And since he'd never had a definitive biography, that was everything. And I wrote multiple chapters about the first part of his life. And I sent it off to John, all proud of myself. And he sent me back this terse email that said, "This is not your best work. I don't know what you're missing, but you're missing something important." He was no historian, but he knew I didn't have the question that I talked about in my remarks to the bio conference. What is your book about? And so it forced me to go back to the historiography and to read. Joyce Appleby became a great American historian who's since passed on, became a great mentor to me. And she wrote this wonderful book, among others, about how the Jeffersonians were laissez-faire because the corporation and government act was seen as government intervention in the economy, and that in a much flatter economy than we have now without corporations, essentially, that the idea of let the individual compete and rise was a radical philosophy. And it was radical because the United States still had this culture of deference, a belief that there were ranks in society, that the people who owned property, especially those who collected rents and weren't in the scrum of the marketplace, were the natural leaders of society. They were disinterested in the correct sense. They did not have a stake. And so Vanderbilt represented the Jeffersonian / Jacksonian rebellion against us that said, yes, we all have interests. Let people rise and compete. So the first big battle of his life was as the right-hand man to someone who was opposed to the Livingston steamboat monopoly, a monopoly that had been granted to the Livingston family, one of the old landed gentry of colonial and early national New York. And he'd gotten a grant for a monopoly on steamboats before they were even invented because of who Livingston was. Mm-hmm. And so he got very involved in this. And, you know, I got caught up in the details. It's when John forced me to go back and see what his story, he didn't tell me exactly what to do, but he said, "You're missing something." So I found how historians have written about this great revolution in American society and culture. And then it just, the light bulb went off and I realized, you know, what his role was and how that set the stage to the next period of his career. And then that, which then set the stage for the rise of the corporation and his moving into the corporation, from being anti-corporate to being the great corporate kingpin. And so that relationship with my editor, him being willing to say, "You don't know what you're," he didn't use these words, but he said, "You don't know what your book is about. You're just giving me details. You're giving me facts. You're not disciplining yourself. You're not giving the reader anything to hang on to. You're just, you know, it's one damn thing after another."
Is this something that in your books you find out along the way, or in any of the books have you gone in knowing the story ahead of time?
Both.
Okay.
So with Jesse James, for example, I knew from the beginning that I thought that's why I had the idea for Jesse James, that I wanted to write a book about Civil War and Reconstruction, and that the more I read about Jesse James, I'd read this very academic book about the guerrilla war in Missouri during the Civil War, but it made me think about Jesse James, and the more I read about his read his letters to the press and whatnot, you know, for example, the only time that Jesse James ever said we rob the rich and give to the poor, it was in a letter urging readers to vote against Grant for re-election, saying, you know, we rob the rich and give to the poor, they rob rich and poor alike. So the idea that the Robin Hood image was just incidental to his political appeal, I thought, oh, this makes sense, you know, and this is a way of writing about this subject. I'm changing the way people think about this figure, but I'm also giving them a way into understanding the importance of Reconstruction. And with Custer, early on, I came to this idea of the frontier in time. And early on, I remember I was at the Huntington doing research, and I gave a talk.
It's the Huntington Library in Pasadena.
Library in Pasadena, thank you. And so, you know, three very prominent historians who were fellows there. We had dinner. And they said, what are you working on? Oh, Custer. And they, like, rolled their eyes, you know. And I said, well, you know, what really gives me a handle on Custer is thinking about Eliza Brown, you know, this woman who worked for him for 6 years and yet was also carving out authority and, you know, she had her own agenda. And one of the ways in which I thought about that is I'd read the novel The Good Lord Bird, in which the character Onion is this young enslaved kid. He's not thinking about the great issues of slavery and expansion and abolition. He's trying to get through the day. And thinking about her, and even though she does symbolize emancipation and reconstruction and those possibilities, she is someone who has been raised. Her whole life has been about survival and about protecting herself in a world in which there are no protections for herself and finding any advantage she can find for herself. And she carries that knowledge and the abilities she's honed into Custer's household. And then her relationship, I like to say that Custer allowed me to write a book that passes the Bechdel test.
Which
because
is?
That's the famous feminist who said the most basic feminist test for a work of fiction, like I think it was film specifically, is that two women have a conversation that's not about a man. And so Libby Custer, his wife, is constantly both likes and respects Eliza Brown, but also is at odds with her because Eliza Brown took her authority as female head of the household of the domestic establishment and didn't give it back. Mm-hmm. And so Libby Custer sheds a lot of light on Eliza Brown because she was constantly getting a literary revenge in her memoirs on Eliza Brown and belittling her in ways that reveal how she was actually on the back foot until finally they're out in Kansas and she fires her. And then she shows up after Custer dies as the wife of a black lawyer and public speaker in Ohio. You know, I mean, she's reconstructed her own life. But seeing the importance of that secondary character is a way both of giving us the likability that we like to have. You know, it may not be Custer you like, but there are these people around him are really interesting and you can root for. But also just expanding the scope of the biography, making it about something that other than what every other book has been about, and then also bringing out the meaning of it. But, you know, the historians were not sold on it. I walked away from that dinner like just like having self-doubt and just like having to go back to work and make it work, you know? And the same thing with Roosevelt. The people say, why do we need another book on Roosevelt? I don't know. I hope we need one.
Is this one where you're going in knowing the story or are you finding the story as you go along?
It's a little bit of both. So I mentioned this in my remarks. If I don't change my mind about something important when I'm working on a book, I'm doing it wrong. And so that's been true in all my books. So with Vanderbilt, you know, I really had to discover what the book was truly about. And of course, that was a authentic, definitive life. There'd never been a soup to nuts biography.
How did that fit in the Gene Strauss Morgan and the Robert Caro power broker and the Ron Chernow Titan galaxy? Were you all working on those at the same time?
No, I came after those.
You came after. So yeah. Were you influenced by that, by what they could do?
Yes, yes and no. So, you know, one of the things that I really like to do is to try to understand mindsets that we no longer have anymore. And so, you know, that whole experience I had with Vanderbilt, because his life started earlier than Morgan's, his life started earlier than John D. Rockefeller's, you know, that whole experience of understanding that he came out of the early national period and really a post-colonial mindset, the way people thought about what a corporation was different. The way people thought about money was different. A share of stock. You know, when I start digging into something, I often find that even historians haven't dug deeply enough. They don't understand the words that people are using. And so the historian in me, as well as the biographer, is saying, I've got to really find the mindset this person had that is lost to us now. Like, the world has changed. We don't think that way anymore. For example, a lot of books about the gold market, the way that during the Civil War we established paper currency, but we also had a gold currency still. And so there was a market to exchange paper dollars for gold dollars. And a lot of people, good writers, good historians even, have said, oh, well, you know, this is the price per ounce. No, no, no. Like, it was a currency exchange. And to understand that, you have to really understand, like, the whole economic universe of the mind they had, which we have lost. And then also the meaning of the of that it was a currency exchange opens the door to understanding a huge debate about the role of government in the economy and the role of, you know, these huge changes that then led to the silver debate, et cetera, et cetera. So part of my role, I see the historian side of me says, I've got to dig into this. But it's the biographer side also. They considered things differently than we do now. So by starting earlier with Vanderbilt, I feel like I got into those issues and the way in which the world and the human mind even changed in ways that those other writers did not have to so much. This is the great thing about biography, speaking from my background in history. Human lives blast through all the periodization checkpoints. You know, people don't live their lives according to the nice boundaries we like to set on them, and we study them, the period. So biography is invaluable for history, and I'm sure for many other subjects as well, because the human life gives us the background, or it gives us the aftermath. Like, it carries us through those periods, and seeing somebody who has an agenda, the future is made by people who are from the past. And so the way we think is made by people who thought differently. Mm-hmm. But they created conditions or even rethought things in ways that create the way we think now. And when you get a grip on that, it's intellectually very exciting.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer and historian T.J. Stiles, speaking with fellow biographer John Farrell at BIO's annual conference held in the Graduate Center of the City University of New York in May of this year. Next week, we'll feature the second half of this fascinating conversation. To learn more about BIO or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellian Marie Fillengaines created our theme music. Jenny Skoog is our producer. Carolyn Van Putten, assistant producer. And Shereen Newman is our engineer. I'm executive producer Sonia Williams. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.